It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, President Trump last week retweeted a tweet with the name of the alleged whistleblower whose allegations prompted the impeachment inquiry. We talked to a legal expert about the federal protections for whistleblowers and whether the president may have violated them. First, 2020 is shaping up to be a pretty interesting year for the auto industry. Among the most anticipated new models include several electric vehicles, including from manufacturers you may not even have heard of. In fact, the Wall Street Journal called 2020 a turning point for e-cars. But there's also a lot of talk about non-electric vehicles as well. And if you're not set on having the latest and greatest set of wheels, there are deals to be had on 2019 models. Jamie Page Deaton is the executive editor of the U.S. News Best Cars team. Jamie, nice to have you back on the show.
Thanks for having me, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. So you are following these things closely. Do you also think this is going to be the year of the electric car?
Well, it depends on what you mean by year of the electric car. This is the year where a lot of electric cars are going mainstream. But if you're looking, you know, to look outside your window in December of 2020, you're not going to see a lot of electric cars on the street because it takes a while, even as a lot of car companies are introducing these models, it just takes a while for consumers to adopt them. So this is the year that they're really entering the mainstream, but it's not the year that you're going to see, you know, the highways choked with electric cars.
Well, do we have a good sense of how many people are already driving electric vehicles?
It's very few. If you look at electrified vehicles, which is electric cars as well as gas electric hybrids, they make up less than 3% of the new car market. And so fully electric vehicles make up an even smaller percentage of that new car market. Now that's starting to shift like very, very slowly. We're seeing the numbers move up. But there are a number of factors that hold back the widespread adoption of electric vehicles. Number one is, you know, price. Number two is the infrastructure. So there's not a really great charging infrastructure for a lot of electric car owners. And then number three is right now it's, you know, related to price. Gas prices are relatively low. So there's not a lot of incentive for people to adopt an electric car unless they're really committed to, you know, reducing their carbon footprint and driving clean.
And that infrastructure issue is interesting because it's kind of a chicken and egg, right? They're not going to build a huge infrastructure for being able to plug in electric cars all over the place if there aren't electric cars all over the place, but people aren't going to buy them until there is, right?
Exactly. And it's kind of funny now, if you look at the majority of electric car owners, you know, they actually have a second car as well, and that's related to the infrastructure. Now, there are, you know, you can drive across country in an electric car and you'd be able to charge up. But you have to realize that the charging stations are going to vary in terms of, you know, how quickly they can charge your car. You know, some cars will get charged as quickly as 20 minutes. But if you're in a rush and you show up and there's two cars in front of you in line, well, then you're looking at an hour to get your car fully charged. And, you know, you can charge an electric car and, you know, at home if you have a garage. But that, unless you're going to really go slowly, you know, you can't really plug them into a regular outlet unless you have, you know, 10, 20 hours to devote to charging. So if you put in a charging station, that's another investment. And so there are some hurdles to adoption. But what we're really seeing with electric car buyers now is they tend to be people who have a garage and have a second car. So they can use their electric car for day-to-day use, you know, commuting, things like that. But then for longer trips, they have a gasoline car, so they don't have to worry so much about, you know, range anxiety and running out of juice.
And a lot of the well-known car manufacturers are venturing into or already have put out electric vehicles. But as we said, there are some startups that some people may be hearing about for the first time, such as Rivian, which is coming out with the first major electric pickup sold in the U.S. Tell us about that company.
So Rivian is very interesting because, you know, it's always, it's going to be compared to Tesla because that's the electric car maker that most people are familiar with. Tesla has a very Silicon Valley, very kind of a software-oriented approach to car. Rivian was started by car industry veterans. So it's a little bit more, you know, run like a traditional car company. But Rivian has had, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in investment from companies like Amazon. So they are doing really well on the venture capital front. And their cars, they have a truck and an SUV that they'll be bringing out this year. And while they're going to be a little bit expensive, I think the estimated price, you know, is north of $70,000 for sure. These cars and trucks are just so cool because they do some really neat tricks. On Twitter a couple of days ago, Rivian and Rivian was showcasing what they call a tank turn, because on their truck, each of the wheels can turn independently, which means the truck basically spins in place like a tank. So if, you know, you have trouble parking, that's a really great maneuver to have in addition to having, you know, an electric powertrain.
It might be cheaper to have someone teach you how to park, but
exactly.
Actually, we asked people on the Ideas Network Facebook page what they were thinking about for possible new vehicles in 2020. And Jesse wrote, the Rivian R1T looks so good. It's the only vehicle I'd consider switching to. Now, who wants to give me $100,000? So it is.
Exactly.
It's definitely for people who are comfortable with a certain price range.
Yeah, but you have to remember too, now, I mean, $100,000, that is a lot of money to pay for a truck, but the vast majority of trucks sold in the United States to private buyers, not to fleet buyers, but they tend to be put out like luxury cars. So if you're looking at like an F-150 or a Ram 1500 or a Chevy Silverado, the majority of their sales are north of $60,000. So a lot of truck buyers are treating their purchases like luxury cars and getting them outfitted like luxury cars. So for a portion of truck buyers, that Rivian's not so far out of reach.
We are talking right now with Jamie Page Deaton. She's executive editor of the U.S. News Best Cars team. We're talking about what to look for in cars in 2020. And also on the Ideas Network Facebook page, John wrote, definitely buying or leasing an all-electric plug-in vehicle in 2020. The technology alone is far advanced over gas guzzlers. And is that true? Are they making some big strides in the technology in those electric cars?
I mean, yes, they are. You're getting better range and you're getting it at a lower cost. But at the same time, you know, when you come down to it, both a gas car and an electric car will get you from point A to point B. I think, though, what John's talking about, though, is an electric car will do it much more cleanly because, you know, it's got a much smaller carbon footprint, particularly if you get your electricity from a clean source. So if you have solar, if you have wind energy, or if, you know, at the very least, you're not getting your electricity from a coal-fired plant, you are lessening your carbon footprint by driving an electric car. The other thing that I think a lot of people don't realize with an electric car is the performance is actually very satisfying. I think there's this idea, probably because people are used to gas electric hybrids, that an electric car is going to be slow and uncomfortable, but that's really not the case. Tesla's done a lot to dispel this kind of misconception by showcasing, you know, their launch mode and their ludicrous mode. But really, because an electric car has all the torque on demand, and that torque is what gives you power when you're going from a stop. On a gasoline engine, it has to rev up to give you maximum torque and maximum power. But on an electric car, the second you touch the accelerator, you're taking off at full power. And it is really, really fun to drive an electric car as a performance car. And that's where we're actually seeing a lot of manufacturers move into the electric realm, you know, where you have Porsche putting out the Taycan, which is, you know, their new all-electric model, which is an incredible performance car. You have Audi putting out electric cars. And then you have, you know, GM announcing that Cadillac is going to move to all electric cars with a performance bent. That's one area where I think a lot of consumers might not be aware of the benefits of an electric car. But once you get behind the wheel and you hit, you know, not the gas, you hit the accelerator. It really comes clear, like, wow, their electric cars have a lot to offer.
Well, and that's interesting that you said that, because Ford is putting out a Mustang electric crossover, and that's Mustangs are kind of, you know, the ultimate muscle car.
Exactly. Now, this is something, you know, the Ford Mustang Mach-E, which they debuted at the LA Auto Show this year, you know, this is something that I think put a lot of, you know, Mustang fanatics in a difficult position, because this is a four-door crossover that Ford's calling a Mustang. Now, the Mustang is, you know, a two-door muscle car, sports car, and that's clearly not what the Mach-E is, except when it come down to the performance numbers. I mean, in a straight line, this thing is going to eat, you know, the lunch of any gasoline-powered Mustang, or most gasoline-powered Mustangs, and it's going to do it with a comfortable back seat and a usable cargo area. So that's one that I think a lot of people within the industry are really excited to get behind the wheel of. And, you know, I saw it at the LA Auto Show, and it was just a beautiful car, and it made me think, all right, this is an area where you can get, you know, a number of cars in one package, where you can get a crossover, where you can get a performance car, and you can get an EV from a manufacturer that has, you know, a track record, that has a dealer network that can support you. So that has a lot of, you know, upside for a lot of buyers.
And we talked about price when we were kind of comparing electric pickups to standard pickups. in general, what can we expect to pay for a new electric vehicle when comparing it to a gas-powered vehicle of basically the same class?
Well, you're going to pay more for the most part for an electric vehicle. Now, electric vehicles, depending on which manufacturer they're from, you can lower the price a little bit with tax rebates and tax incentives. So, for example, Mini has a new electric, electric Mini coming out. And this is a subcompact car. It's very small. And Minis tend to run anywhere between $20,000, up to $40,000 because, again, like this is a sub brand from BMW. So it's more luxurious than you're going to get from, your basic Hyundai. But the Mini Electric, which you would expect to be at the high end of the price range, when you take into account all of the tax rebates and things, you can get it for under $20,000. So it really depends on what model you're looking at and, what rebates and incentives are available in terms of taxes, from the manufacturer. I would also say, too, though, as we mentioned earlier, electric cars and hybrids are a very, very small part of the new car market. So that's one area where, again, because they're not super popular with consumers as a whole, you can get some incredible deals. In the DC area, the Hyundai Ioniq EV was leasing for $79 a month this past month, which is incredible. So you can find some really, really great deals by looking at these electric cars simply because they're not popular and you can get all the benefits while, saving yourself some money at the dealership.
That's very surprising, I have to say. We're talking about what the automobile industry may have in store for us in 2020. Jamie Page Deaton is with us. She's the executive editor of the U.S. News Best Cars team. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you in the market for a new vehicle? What kind of car, truck, or maybe SUV are you considering? Are you interested in an electric vehicle? And what questions do you have about what's coming out in 2020? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Right now, we're picking up the conversation on which cars to keep an eye on in 2020. Jamie Page Deaton is our guest. She's the executive editor of the U.S. News Best Cars team. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Is there a particular vehicle or type of vehicle you're thinking about buying in the new year? What features are most important to you? And do you already have an electric vehicle or are you still not convinced? What questions do you have about what's coming out in 2020? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. And let's go to the phones and Julie in Menasha is up. Hi, Julie.
Hi. I was wondering if you get an electric car, you have a garage, what is the initial investment for charging and how does that affect your utility bill?
Great. Thanks for that call, Julie. And Jamie?
That is a really great question. So how much it costs is going to depend because a lot of areas have, even individual municipalities will have incentives to get you to put these types of charging stations in your home. But generally speaking, you're looking at anywhere from $2,000 to $5,000 to put one in. When it comes down to your actual electric bill, though, it's like adding another refrigerator to your family is how it's basically yeah. how it comes out. And on a per mile basis, it is still much less expensive than gasoline. But where you're really going to see the money pay off is, in a couple of areas. One is if you're in an area where you have super cheap electricity, that can help. If you charge your car during non-peak hours, and a lot of electric cars have settings, where they have a smartphone app where you can plug your car in when you come home from work, but then say, don't start charging until we hit non-peak hours where the electricity rates are lower. So that's a great way to save money. Because again, compared to that refrigerator, which is running all the time, only charging your car on non-peak hours will save you a little bit. And I have yet to see a gas station that says, hey, you can save, 5 cents off a gallon of gas if you come in at non-peak hours. And then if gas prices go up, you're protected from that. And you'll start to see, even on a per mile basis, that cost of driving an electric car will be, that much lower than driving a gasoline powered car. So there is some initial upfront investment, but look around within, your county, your state, and your town, because there might might be some surprising incentives that can give you a break on that upfront investment of putting in a charging station.
Thanks for that call, Julie. And let's stay on the electric car topic with Kim in Monroe. Hi, Kim.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead.
So I have a green business called the Green Goats, where I rent out goats for weed control. So I felt kind of guilty driving around in my big pickup truck. And my mom is 90 years old, so to drive my pickup truck to go see her is $45 in gas.
Wow.
So the goats had a good year, so the goats bought me a Chevy Bolt, which is all electric. And now it costs me about $4 in electricity instead of $45 in gas. And that means I can go see my mom whenever I have the time rather than having to, you know, calculate the cost in my head.
That's a great comparison to share with us, Kim. So instead of 40-something dollars, about $4, that seems like a pretty good savings, Jamie.
Yeah, that's an excellent savings. And the Bolt is a great choice for an electric car. I mean, I think when people think about, you know, Chevrolet, they think of either the Corvette or they think of the Silverado. But Chevy's been making electrified cars, and the Bolt is one of the first kind of mass market electric cars that they brought out. It was North American Car of the Year a couple years ago. And it really is just a fun car to drive. And again, it's, I will say, as great of a car as it is, it's not particularly popular. So you can get a deal on it almost any time that you go shopping for a new car. So if you're thinking of an electric car, go take a look at the Bolt.
Thanks for that call, Kim. And let's go to Chuck in Madison next. Hi, Chuck.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good. What do you have to share?
Good. Well, I am driving a Nissan Leaf electric right now as we speak. I just listened to your broadcast. In Madison, Wisconsin, there are tons of free chargers at restaurants, grocery stores. I'm going to one right now. On this car, if I was paying for electricity, it's about two and a half cents a mile.
Great. That's great to know. So, Jamie, does that kind of fit in with what you've been seeing as far as cost per mile?
It does. And I would say, too, you know, I think it's great that Madison has all the charging stations. And Chuck is pointing out a great benefit for a lot of electric car owners is that in a lot of places, the charging stations are free, at least for the first hour or two, because a lot of businesses will put them out because they want you to come in and shop there while your car is charging. But I would also say, too, you know, Madison is a college town. I used to live just outside of Iowa City, so there was a great charging network there. But when you get into other areas, the charging network can be a little bit where there's, you know, those areas where there's lower adoption, the charging network can be a little bit thinner, and you really do have to plan your routes. So it really comes down to, you know, if you're going to save a lot of money, like Chuck pointed out, you know, 2 cents a mile, that's great. You know, a lot of gas cars aren't going to be able to meet that per mile cost. But, you know, if you're concerned about range anxiety or anything like that, check out the charging network in your area. There are a ton of smartphone apps that can help you find chargers in your area. So you'll know if you've got, you know, the ability to plug in or, you know, look into plugging in at home.
Thanks for that call. And let's go now to Gary in Sheboygan. Hi, Gary.
Hello. I'm wondering if they would make an electric car that's a four-wheel drive. I'm up in like the snow area here. And, you know, I'm wondering if it's just front-wheel drive or if it's four, you know, if we could get it in a four-wheel drive.
Great. Thanks, Gary. I want to make sure Jamie has a chance to respond.
Yeah, not four-wheel drive yet, unless you're going for that Rivian truck. But a number of them do have all-wheel drive. And I have to say, in my experience living in Iowa, living in New Hampshire, front-wheel drive plus a good set of snow tires will do almost as well as four-wheel drive in a lot of places. So even if you're going for a front-wheel drive electric car, just put on some snow tires and see how you do. You might be surprised.
Thanks for that call, Gary, and keep watching. I'm sure eventually it'll get there. Wyatt in Viroqua is up next. Hi, Wyatt.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I just want to comment that I have a Tesla, a Model 3, and it's the all-wheel drive version, and it is awesome in the snow. I probably put 19,000 miles on it this year. Going all over Wisconsin, and if you use the PlugShare app, it's easy to find charging destination chargers. We were just in Fish Creek and Bailey's Harbor. All of them are free, so which means that the cost of driving your vehicle is nearly free. And, and the cost of installing a charger at home, you can do something pretty simple as just using the your stove or your dryer outlet. I have another one installed for like $65 by electrician. And then the Tesla charger is $500 in a couple hours. So you can have it installed well under $1,000 and have maintenance free. I mean, you have to remember you have no oil changes, right? Your brakes last significantly larger. I have a friend who has over 100,000 miles on his Tesla and has not had to replace the brakes once.
And, well, I have to leave it there. We're running short on time, Wyatt. So it sounds like there might be some workarounds even for that upfront cost of getting the infrastructure set up.
There are. And I think, you know, Wyatt's point, though, just so you know that, you know, the Tesla is at the forefront of putting in charge and charging infrastructure for their vehicle owners. Not all electric cars will work with Tesla chargers. So while you're looking at the smartphone apps, then looking for chargers, you need to make sure that you're going to find one that'll work with your electric car.
Thanks for that information, Wyatt. And Jared in Oregon asked if the Volkswagen Buzz is still going to happen. He heard about that as an electric car option.
You know, this is a funny thing because Volkswagen has really made a push into the EV area. And it seems like every car show, they're debuting a new electrified and electric concept. But the Buzz, like nothing's come to market yet. And so the Buzz is one. It looks like a retro Volkswagen van. I absolutely love this car. I want it to come to market because I want to buy it. and yet it's still not for sale. So I think it's supposed to come to market in 2022 because Volkswagen, like I said, they've been doing a lot of talk about electric vehicles. And outside of the electric Golf, really none of their concepts have really made it to market yet. So just keep watching this space because, you know, like you, I really want to get inside that Buzz. It looks so cool and so much fun.
So, Jamie, we are just about out of time. We didn't get to any of the other topics because there was so much interest in the electric vehicle topic. Will you come back with us really soon so we can talk about SUVs and all kinds of other stuff?
Yes, absolutely.
That would be great. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, and we will have you back on soon for the rest of the story.
Thanks so much, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Jamie Page Deaton is the executive editor of the U.S. News Best Cars team. We talked with her about what we can expect from the automobile industry in the new year. We focused on electric cars. There was a lot of interest. We didn't get to a lot of other topics, so we will have her back soon to cover the rest. Coming up after the news, we'll talk about the legal implications of President Trump's retweet last week of a tweet with the name of the alleged whistleblower at the heart of the impeachment process. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. In for Rob Ferret, you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, an editor from the Merriam-Webster Dictionary joins us to talk about their word of the year, they as a singular pronoun. First, President Trump is getting new criticism after he retweeted a tweet Friday that included the name of the alleged whistleblower at the heart of the impeachment process. The move got a mixed response from Republicans in Congress, some of whom defended the president and others who were more hesitant. But he got fast pushback from many legal experts and Democrats who say it could amount to retaliation against the whistleblower, which they're shielded from under federal law. Barb McQuaid is a professor at the University of Michigan Law School. She's also the former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan. Barb, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. President Trump has talked a lot about the whistleblower, but was this going further than he's gone before?
Well, it is in that he is publishing the name of the whistleblower. You know, I come at this from a national security perspective. And the reason we have whistleblower protection laws, especially to protect those in the intelligence community, is to provide an outlet for people who believe they have identified fraud, waste, and abuse. And if you don't have a legal channel for people to share that information, you are pushing them into one of two other directions, both of which I think are harmful to our nation. One is leaks. It encourages people to go through unlawful channels to the press when they have what they believe is some sort of abuse or fraud or other misconduct that's going on. The other avenue is silence. If people don't feel like there's a safe way for them to expose wrongdoing, then they'll sit on it and keep it quiet And that also is inconsistent with our idea of transparency in government. So I believe both of those avenues are dangerous for a democracy and for a president to try to out someone who has gone through the proper legal channels to expose wrongdoing is to encourage silence or leaking, both of which are damaging.
Barb, my understanding is that there is not one overarching blanket protection for federal whistleblowers. It's much more a patchwork of different types of protection. What protections should federal whistleblowers be able to count on?
Yeah, the law that protects people in the intelligence community really just says that it permits them to go to the inspector general and says the inspector general cannot disclose their identity and there can't be employment retaliation against that person for going through that channel, for going to the inspector general.
And go ahead.
Oh, and so it would be useful perhaps to see additional protections beyond just the inspector general from those third parties from disclosing their identity, which is what the president is seeking to do.
What are some of the things that meet that definition of retaliation when it comes to these whistleblowers?
Well, it means workplace retaliation. So you can't be fired. You can't be demoted as a result of your disclosures through the Whistleblower Protection Act. But it doesn't say anything about third parties like a president from putting your name out there that can expose you to ridicule or harassment. And in this world of online threats, having that person's name out there can result in all kinds of things, including exposing him to violence. And so when the president puts his name out there, harasses him, intimidates him, I think it can create other kinds of harms that probably weren't considered in the 1990s when this legislation was first enacted.
And I should say that WPR, along with other news organizations like NPR, are not saying the alleged whistleblower's name on the air. We are talking with Barb McQuaid right now, a professor at the University of Michigan Law School. She's also the former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan. And we are talking about the fact that President Trump retweeted a tweet over the weekend that had the name of that alleged whistleblower. And Barb, I think the question that a lot of people come down to on all sides of this is, was what the president did illegal? In your opinion, was it?
I think it's not illegal, but I think it's an example of poor leadership. You know, so often what we see from this president are not things that are illegal per se, but violations of norms, violations of good citizenship, violations of morality, ethics, and leadership. We would hope for a president that says, I believe that what I did was lawful. I welcome the scrutiny. I welcome the accountability. I understand and recognize the Congress as a co-equal branch of government, and I will put my conduct before them, and I believe I can withstand that scrutiny. Instead, what he does is he doubles down on his illegal behavior. He circles the wagons and gets his tribe riled up against anyone who would dare to criticize him. And that is what I believe is antithetical to the kind of transparency and accountability that we have in a democratic government like ours. The whistleblower has shared information. That information should be brought to bear in Congress as it's supposed to. We look at it, we examine it, and we decide whether it's lawful. Instead, President Trump attacks those who attack him, and that is antithetical, I believe, to our democratic form of government.
I want to listen to how some Republicans are defending this. This is U.S. House Majority Whip Steve Scalise on Fox News Sunday this weekend.
Yeah, the whistleblower absolutely ought to be known and testify. Look, they tried to take out a sitting president. Everybody in America has the right to face their accusers. Mm-hmm. Why should the president be denied that same constitutional right?
Barb, what do you make of that line of defense?
So that is a really cynical trick that he's playing there, this idea of confronting one's accusers. The Sixth Amendment to the Constitution does permit someone who's been accused of a crime to cross-examine the percipient witnesses against them. So the whistleblower is like the person who calls in the tip. The police investigate, and then the people who are the eyewitnesses to the crime come in and testify, and you have an opportunity to cross-examine them. This is like someone calling the police to say the bank was just robbed. the people who testify are the people who witnessed the bank robbery, the bank tellers, the citizens who were in the bank at the time. Those are the people who are subject to cross-examination. And you bet, let's hear from those people. Let's hear from the people who participated in the phone calls, like Mick Mulvaney, like Rudy Giuliani, like Mike Pompeo, like John Bolton. Those are the witnesses to the crime. The whistleblower is the person who became aware of this and provided the tip to the people who are investigating.
So on the other hand, Barb, not everyone in the president's party is endorsing this action. Here is Republican Senator John Kennedy of Louisiana on CNN this Sunday.
With respect to what the president tweeted, look, I have enough trouble paddling my own canoe, but I do agree with Mrs. Trump that, and I've suggested before to the White House that if the president would tweet a little bit less, it wouldn't cause brain damage. But the president does not have to take my advice, nor do I expect him to.
Is there some trepidation here, Barb, among Republicans when they're talking about this retweet with the alleged whistleblower's name without actually saying he shouldn't have retweeted that?
Yeah, you know, I don't know if that's sort of a clever way of trying to get around addressing it head on. You know, Twitter is a medium just like any other. And it's a great opportunity to get someone's message across. But when you retweet, it's sort of a way of kind of endorsing a message without saying it yourself. And so I think the president uses Twitter in a very effective way for him. He is able to pass on messages, but then sort of keep his hands out of it, his fingerprints off of it, if you will, by saying, well, I didn't tweet it. I just retweeted a message, and I didn't read it very carefully before I did so. I think he knows exactly what he's doing. I think there's something President Trump is very good at. He's very good at messaging and selling and using slogans and shorthand to persuade people who maybe don't have time or expertise to get into the weeds and into the details of things. And so I think that he uses Twitter very effectively. And maybe Republicans are uncomfortable with it because of the sinister way that he makes use of it. But I think he uses it very cleverly. And, you know, the way to get around that or to respond to it is to just make people aware of the way that he's using Twitter. You know, the answer to bad information is more information to provide enlightenment to other people.
We have no idea right now what the Senate trial will look like, whether there will be any witnesses or not. But some have floated the idea that the whistleblower may be called in that Senate trial. Do you think that's a possibility?
He may be called. I would be very surprised if he actually comes and testifies. I think John Roberts is the presiding judge there. The justice will avoid having it become a circus. There's absolutely no relevance to his testimony if he has no firsthand information. The only reason to call the whistleblower would be to intimidate him and to try to have a chilling effect on others who might dare to call out President Trump. And so I think if he's called, Justice Roberts will find him not to have relevant testimony. Now, if the Senate wants to, they can overrule Justice Roberts with a simple majority vote. But I think they, too, want to avoid a circus-like atmosphere. So we'll see what Senator Schumer and Senator McConnell are able to work out in advance to avoid this. I know there have been some suggestion of calling Joe or Hunter Biden as well. And similarly, the only reason to call them would be to harass them. They have no firsthand information about the matters under consideration which relate to impeachment, President Trump's conduct with regard to Ukraine. And I think Justice Roberts will work hard to keep things on focus.
And Barb, when it comes to the whistleblower's role in the impeachment process, what will you be watching for next?
Well, I hope the whistleblower is protected and we don't see anything more about him or her. That would really be the best way to treat that person. I hope that people are respectful of the process. Whistleblowers, you know, exist. Whistleblower protection laws exist in our country to give them an avenue, to give them an alternative besides silence and leaking, to have a lawful channel to share information and have their identity protected. So the best thing that could happen to the whistleblower is that we never hear from him or about him again. I hope that's what happens.
Well, Barb, thanks so much for taking the time to join us today.
You're welcome. Thanks very much and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. That was Barb McQuaid. She's a professor with the University of Michigan Law School and former U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan. She was with us today to talk about the federal protections for whistleblowers and whether the president publicly sharing the name of the alleged whistleblower on Twitter last week may have violated them. Coming up, according to the people at Merriam-Webster Dictionary, they as a singular pronoun is the word of the year. We'll find out about its long history, even before current uses in a multi-gendered context. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, is learning a new language one of your resolutions for 2020? We'll talk about the benefits of speaking a new language and get advice on how to get started. Now, in other word and language news, the staff of the Merriam-Webster Dictionary has dubbed they as a singular pronoun their word of the year. Its growing use has met with resistance in some quarters, while others point out that it has actually been used that way for a long, long time. Peter Sokolowski is editor-at-large for Merriam-Webster. Peter, thanks for joining us today.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Well, I have to imagine it's fun putting together the word of the year list, and we'll talk about some of the runners up a little later. But first, can you explain how they is being used today as a singular pronoun?
Sure. There's really two different uses. One is what is usually referred to as the singular they, which has been used in English for about 600 years or so, and partly is kind of a way to fill a gap in the language. That is to say that we don't have a pronoun that corresponds neatly with singular pronouns like everyone or someone or anyone, in which case you're referring to a single individual, but it's a person who is unknown. So you don't know if that person is a male or a female person. And the word they has been used in that context for 600 years. It's the kind of sentence like, no one has to go if they don't want to. Everyone knew where they stood. Everybody likes pizza, don't they? Those are kinds of uses that are pretty unremarkable in English. Now, there's this more recent phenomenon, which we date back to around 2005, which we call the non-binary they, which is to say that it is used to refer to a single person, an individual whose gender identity is non-binary, which is to say that they do not refer to themselves as either a he or she. And so it is a choice on the part of that speaker to use they in that instance.
So in that second sense, and that is the sense that made it the word of the year, some people have said that it shouldn't be accepted and that it's grammatically incorrect. How do you respond to that?
There's nothing grammatically incorrect about using no one has to go if they don't want to, for example. I suspect that there are some people who refer to a kind of traditional grammar that is, in fact, not organic to the English language. There are many rules that some people call zombie rules, like, never end a sentence with a preposition or never split an infinitive verb, for example. But those are rules that were superimposed on the language in the 18th century when grammar books were first being written. And so, in a sense, they were the rules of people who had learned Latin in school applied to English, and that doesn't necessarily work. So the fact is, it's perfectly grammatical, and it always has been in English to do those things, any of those things, ending a sentence with a preposition or splitting an infinitive, or certainly using they to refer to a single individual. This new one has to do with, in a sense, just a changing sense of a person's identity. And that is something that the dictionary really has no place in. All we can do is recognize the language that is used as it's been used. And it's used sufficiently frequently that we added this definition to the dictionary in the past year. And we only add definitions or new words to the dictionary if they are frequently used.
Peter Sokolowski is editor-at-large for Merriam-Webster Dictionary, and we are talking about the word of the year and the runners-up. This year's word of the year is they as a singular pronoun. And Peter, languages are always evolving. It's one of the great things about them. Do you expect that there will be a time that this use of the pronoun they doesn't even register as different or new?
I think lexicographers make lousy prognosticators, so I'm not going to predict. We do have some historical precedent. However, we do certainly see that they is often used Again, as a singular they, and it's unremarkable. Most people wouldn't notice it. Maybe they would correct it in formal writing, but again, a sentence like "no one has to go if they don't want to" would pass muster for most of us, and in fact, we wouldn't even notice it. What's interesting about this is that the pronoun "you" was altered about 400 years ago, or rather its use was altered, because we used to say in the English language "thee" and "thou" to refer to an individual person in the second person. And "you" was used as the plural or for people of superior social rank, which is the kind of pronouns that the second person has in European languages. Like in French, you have vous and tu, and in German, there are other parallels. But the thee and thou in English, as you know perfectly well, have fallen away, and they are only used now in sort of poetry and prayers. They are recognized as archaic parts of the language, and I can refer to an individual, such as yourself, with the word "you" and a plural verb. I would say, "You are speaking to me now on WPR," and that is a change in the language that we register. In other words, we understand and we think it's perfectly grammatical to use the plural verb with "you," as we would with "we," for example. And so with "they," I think that is a solid step grammatically in that same direction. At the same time, any change in language that happens that we notice is likely to seem very strange to many of us, and it will seem strange for a long time.
I want to talk about a couple of the other contenders for this year's Word of the Year. And one is, I think, "the."
Yes. This is one.
Surely this... you've heard that before, Peter.
Yeah. What's interesting is now our words of the year are generated quantitatively. These are words that are looked up frequently in the dictionary. We have about 100 million page views a month at Merriam-Webster.com. We have 2 billion words looked up a year on the apps. So we have a huge amount of data to reflect upon how the dictionary is being used. It just so happened that the word "the" was looked up in August when the Ohio State University filed a trademark application for the word, because they have as their official name the Ohio State University, not Ohio State University. So many people, first of all, it was reported in the press. It got a lot of attention. The trademark application was denied, but it did draw a lot of attention to one of the most basic and one of the oldest words in the English language, which is "the" or "the."
That makes a lot more sense. A word that we have heard a whole lot this year, especially the second half of the year. Well, actually, a phrase, quid pro quo.
Yes. Well, I'm not surprising at all, because the lookups in the dictionary do reflect the news. And clearly the news is political. That has been the big story for a number of years. And we have certainly noticed that when a term seems technical or medical or legal, those are the words that people tend to look up in the dictionary. And quid pro quo is certainly a legal term. It's a technical term. It's not in everybody's everyday vocabulary. And because it's such an important part of such an important story, it makes perfect sense that people would go to the dictionary and check it out.
I found this one interesting too, because I read the book that I think is related to it, is Crawdad.
Oh, that's right. And what's interesting here is it shows kind of, I think, the way the dictionary works, which is, even though often we see words like quid pro quo or impeach in our lookup data, the dictionary is not there to measure the news. It's there to measure the language. And crawdad is an unusual word for a lot of people. It is a huge bestseller. And congratulations to Delia Owens for her great novel.
It's called Where the Crawdads Sing.
Where the Crawdad Sings, exactly. And it's been at the top of the New York Times bestseller list for nearly a year, I think. She was profiled on CBS Sunday Morning. But that word, it's an unusual word. It's sort of an alteration of crawfish or crayfish. And it's very kind of local to the southeast, you know, the Louisiana basin. And so it's a colorful word. It's a word that people encountered maybe by reading rather than hearing, and which might encourage them to look it up in the dictionary.
And our producer, Rachel Owen, says yes, because they should be called crawdads, not crawfish. So there, you can include that in the next edition. I know that you said that you lexicographers, I believe, are not good prognosticators was your very pithy phrase. But any predictions, what realm 2020's word might come from?
Oh, you know, to be honest, what's interesting is that a word like "they" is really about the language and the culture put together. Clearly, there's a focus on politics. Our top 10 list will always have political terms. And you know what? To be honest, they always have had political terms. So this.
Well, we'll look for those political terms. Peter, thank you so much for joining us today. Peter Sokolowski is editor-at-large for Merriam-Webster Dictionary. He was with us to discuss why the singular pronoun they was chosen as their word of the year. And tomorrow morning, Keely Boltino will talk about words that should be banished from our vocabularies tomorrow at 7. It can be easy to complain about how cold it can get during a Wisconsin winter, and there are a lot of people who try to get out of the Midwest for a long weekend, a week, maybe longer if they can, to escape. But then summer comes, and those hot and humid days can be a challenge to live with, too. Well, an ambitious Alaska meteorologist named Brian Bretschneider plotted out an interesting U.S. road trip. It would allow you to be in that lovely 70-degree zone for an entire year. This is not for the faint of heart or for those who don't like spending a lot of time in a car. It means driving more than 13,000 miles and takes you from the southern tip of Texas up to Alaska and then down the coast of California again to San Diego. He did do a variation for those who aren't keen on driving up to Alaska. He made one that's 9,125 miles that stays in the lower 48. I know you are all wondering if this 70-degree quest passes through Wisconsin. In fact, it does. Brett Schneider recommends going through Pittsburgh and Chicago in May and then making your way to northern Wisconsin on June 1st. And on the map, it looks like that would be around Manitowish Waters or maybe Mercer. Of course, with it being based on average high temperatures, there is no guarantee that the weather will cooperate. And Brett Schneider himself has not done the drive and doesn't plan on it. He says he loves the weather year-round in his hometown of Anchorage, Alaska. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR, and then we'll talk about learning a new language as an adult. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.